This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the United Nations says nearly 3 million people in drought-stricken Zimbabwe are going hungry. The world body expects that number to exceed 4 million as the full impact of the El Nino weather phenomenon kicks in.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next.
Also in Burundi, the Associated Press reports gunmen killed 3 people last night in the capital, including a retired army colonel. And in Nigeria recently, there's been a rise in militant attacks on farmers by well-armed gangs.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations says nearly 3 million people in drought-stricken Zimbabwe are going hungry. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva that the world body expects the number to exceed 4 million as the full impact of the El Nino weather phenomenon kicks in.
UN resident coordinator for Zimbabwe, Bisho Parajuli, says the impact of little rain and low crop yields following 2 years of drought is painfully visible in Matabele land and other dry lands.
I recently visited that area with a number of donors and ambassadors. We could really see the desperation and the severity of the situation.
A few weeks ago, the United Nations appealed for $360 million to provide life-saving assistance for more than 3 million people. The priority needs are for food, water, health, nutrition, sanitation, and protection. Parajuli says $70 million has been received, leaving a gap of $290 million. He says it is critical for donors to respond generously and immediately to this appeal.
Given Zimbabwe, a landlocked country, and also the whole Southern Africa region is affected by El Nino and lack of surplus of maize, it's very critical to plan in advance in terms of importation and supply chain delivery. So early response will really help save lives and suffering among population.
Parajuli says he is particularly worried about the so-called lean season between September and March. This is the period between harvests when farmers' food stocks are at their lowest. He says people will be severely affected by the lack of food, and many will not be able to count on their cattle as a lifeline, as tens of thousands have died from lack of water and grazing land. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Heavy fighting was reported today between government troops and Al-Shabaab militants in southwestern Somalia. VOA Somali Service quotes the commander of Somali forces as saying at least 11 militants were killed near the town of El Waq, about 9 kilometers from the Kenyan border. 2 government soldiers reportedly sustained minor injuries. Reports say the fighting started early in the morning when militants attacked a military base in the town.
In Burundi, the Associated Press reports gunmen killed 3 people last night in the capital, including a retired army colonel. Unknown gunmen killed Colonel Ruifi Luchin as he entered his home in Bujumbura's Ngangara neighborhood. The AP says in a separate incident, gunmen on motorcycles killed the chief of judicial police and a guard at a beer warehouse in Imwero province in central Burundi. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks. Hundreds of people have died in violence since April of last year when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. The opposition called it unconstitutional. About 260,000 people have fled to neighboring countries. 4 days of peace talks ended this week in Arusha, Tanzania. But many Burundi opposition figures who are in exile did not attend.
Music. migrants are being rescued every day on the Mediterranean Sea as they are to make their way to Europe. Many of them are sub-Saharan Africans, discovered in old wooden boats or rubber dinghies. About 1,400 people have died making the journey, but the exact number may never be known. It is not clear how many of those flimsy vessels capsize and sink without any rescue in sight. Rescue vessels have been very busy over the past 2 days. Reporter Antonella Sferraza is following developments from Palermo, Sicily. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Some 3,000 migrants were saved off the Libyan coast yesterday in a single day in 38 separate rescue missions. The Italian Coast Guard say this meant that more than 5,600 migrants had been rescued from various boats in the southern Mediterranean in just 2 days. Coast Guard boats, vessels from the European Union Naval Operation and its border agency Frontex, a boat from the humanitarian organization SOS Mediterranee, and two tugboats from an offshore oil platform and one merchant ship were all involved in the rescue operation of these 2 days. The majority of the migrants rescued have not yet arrived in Italy. Two rescue vessels will arrive today in Sicily, one with 1,000 migrants on board in Palermo and another one in Messina this evening. Other three vessels are expected to arrive tomorrow in other Italian ports like Salerno near Naples and Brindisi and in Sardinia. And unfortunately, we have a bad news to give as a little baby, a 2.5 baby from Cameroon, has been transferred from the SOS Mediterranean ship to hospital by helicopter as he was found dehydrated and with serious problems.
So a 2.5-year-old child from Cameroon. Any word about the child's parents?
The child's mother, she's okay. But the baby is in a very serious conditions because he can't breathe properly. Now he's in Palermo Hospital and we are waiting to know about his health conditions. You have to imagine that these people are found after days of the desert and then the seas.
Antonella, what happens when these migrants and refugees arrive in Italy? Do they have to stay in Italy? Are they able to go to other European countries, for example?
This is a good question in the sense that, first of all, they are ferried to the reception center in Italy. Then they have to be identified. And then the people who have the right to apply for the asylum seeker procedure, they should be relocated in other European countries. But the problem is that this reallocation plan is not working. Since September, only 580 migrants have been relocated in other European countries. And according to the Brussels Agreement, 36,000 should be relocated in 2 years, but at the moment only 580. So, as usual, European Union is not so united. Officials fear that the numbers trying to make the crossing to Italy will increase as weather conditions continue to improve. And also, humanitarian organizations say that the sea route between Libya and Italy is now the main route for asylum seekers heading for Europe.
The 36,000 people that you mentioned that are supposed to be relocated, are they all in Italy?
Yes, they are. They are. We have something like 100,000 migrants in our reception centers waiting to know if their request of asylum has been accepted and then waiting to be relocated. They are all in Italy.
Well, let's talk about northern Italy, the Alps, its border with Austria at the Brenner Pass. There has been some controversy, of course, as Austria wants to impose migrant controls there. Any new information about that?
Well, we can say that Vienna does not trust Italy. The Austrian Interior Minister said that Italy has not kept its promises, and so it decided to send 80 more police and support staff to boost the patrols around the Alpine Brenner Pass in order to catch rising numbers of registered migrants coming from Italy. Austria said illegal crossings started to increase last week. Austria talks about 40 or 50 migrants passing the border every day. Italy denies, saying that is true the contrary, that is migrants who enter Italy from Austria. The truth is that they are both right. There are reports, many reports, confirming that migrants enter Italy from Austria and vice versa.
That's reporter Antonella Sferraza from Palermo. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. In other migrant news, Eritrean President Isaias Afewerki says many people are fleeing his country because foreign powers are trying to weaken it. Eritreans are among the migrants heading for Europe. Mr. Isaias says they are being encouraged to leave, depleting his country of human capital. His government reportedly has jailed thousands of political opponents and journalists. Meanwhile, Greek police continue to evacuate the makeshift migrant and refugee camp at Idomene on the Macedonian border. About 2,000 people were evacuated yesterday. Police hope to relocate about the same number today. There were about 8,400 people in the camp prior to the evacuations. Macedonia has refused to reopen its border and allow the migrants to enter. And Germany's cabinet has approved new measures to help the more than 1 million asylum seekers in the country. The Associated Press says the measures provide better access to jobs and language training.
Within hours of the announcement of Turkey's new government being announced, a major dispute over visas erupted today between Turkey and the European Union. It threatens one of the main foreign policy achievements of the ousted prime minister and could affect the deal over migrant flows. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is accusing Brussels of double standards and warned he's ready to freeze a key migrant readmission agreement with the European Union. Turkey has committed itself to accepting back all migrants that enter neighbouring Greece illegally in exchange for billions of euros in aid and visa-free travel for its citizens to much of Europe. The deal was crafted by former Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, who was recently ousted by Erdogan. Political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says a dispute with Brussels underlines Erdogan's new authority.
The whole point of getting rid of Davutoğlu and appointing a new one is that policy would be entirely made in Erdogan's palace. I don't think the new, for instance, the foreign minister will even be able to tell you what Turkey's policy vis-a-vis EU is or will be. He'll have to consult Erdogan or his advisors.
The latest dispute centres on EU insistence that Turkey narrows its definition of terrorism in its anti-terror law as one of the 72 criteria it needs to comply with to gain visa-free travel. Erdogan has made little secret of his distrust of Europe, a stance observers say is empty rhetoric that plays well with Turkish nationalists he is courting before an expected referendum to increase his presidential powers. Carnegie Institute visiting scholar Sinan Ülgen says that perception may be a mistake, with the country battling Kurdish rebels and Islamic State militants.
The Turkish president has stated clearly that Turkey has no intention to change its anti-terror legislation at a time when it is under an acute threat of terrorism. And therefore, we have now reached a situation of stalemate. And if neither party budges, then it is unclear how this deal will be implemented successfully. So right now, it is really under jeopardy.
Since a deal was struck, migrants entering Greece from Turkey have dramatically fallen from thousands a day to single digits. Political columnist Kadri Gusel of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and Al Monitor website warns the migrant deal could be all that is holding EU-Turkish relations together.
Erdogan is becoming a figure in the perceptions of the Western public opinions comparable to any Middle Eastern dictator. So it will be very easy to break up with this Turkey run by, you know, such a leader. But breaking up with Turkey will have unpredictable, bitter consequences on Europe's security and stability, especially in the first place for the Balkan region. And this is a really very, very difficult dilemma.
Ankara has invested millions of dollars across the Balkans, courting Muslim minorities. The state-backed programs are part of Erdogan's vision of projecting Turkey's influence beyond its traditional allies. It's a point underlined by Turkey's new EU affairs minister, Ömer Çelik, a close ally of Erdogan, who warned Wednesday the European Union is not Turkey's only option. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Twenty past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien says West Africa's Lake Chad region is the world's most neglected humanitarian crisis. O'Brien spoke this week at the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul. Reuters reports he described the crisis as the most underreported, underfunded, and least addressed of the big crises the world faces. A senior Red Cross official says the gap between those in need and the humanitarian response may be bigger than in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. The Lake Chad crisis is fueled by displacement caused by Boko Haram militant attacks, as well as by poverty and desertification. The UN and Red Cross official warn that nearly a half a million children are at risk without emergency food aid. In 2015, the UN appealed for $535 million for the region. However, donors provided less than half of that.
In Nigeria recently, there's been a rise in militant attacks on farmers by well-armed gangs. The violence has fueled public demands for an end to the clashes and a decades-long conflict between Christian farming communities and Fulani cattlemen. Analysts say there is no evidence of who the killers really are, even though some have blamed the Fulani. In part one of two reports, VOA's David Arnold looks at who may be engaging in the recent violence.
The Fulani are believed to be the world's largest semi-nomadic group, ethnic cattle keepers divided by name and custom and spread for centuries across a vast African landscape. In Nigeria, some Fulani who drive their cattle herds through farm communities are gaining a reputation, possibly unfairly earned, as well-armed killers who have attacked villages such as Agatu, Okpanchenyi, and Ichama in Benue State and other villages in the states of Plateau and Kaduna. Lena Hoffman is an associate fellow at the London-based Chatham House think tank. She says so far the government in Abuja has not been very responsive to the problem.
There is very little information as to which group is responsible for the burning of villages and most of the killings we've heard about. There has been a long-standing banditry problem that I think a number of herding communities have tried to get law enforcement to pay attention to, and there has been very little response from law enforcement as to dealing with problems of cattle rustling, criminal groups, etc. No one knows for sure where these groups of people are coming from. Are they from within Nigeria, crossing the borders? But they're operating certainly in a very military fashion.
Shola Tayo is also an associate fellow at Chatham House. She says much of the public pressure for government action against the herdsmen came from a global terrorism index last year.
There's been a real push, certainly in the political class, to try and turn this into a national security issue. I think probably the biggest factor, though, was the classification of the most deadly terrorist organizations, and the Fulani herdsmen came in at number four. And that's really the first time that they've kind of been lumped together and labeled as organized terrorist groupings like Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda.
Tayo takes exception to that ranking. She argues that the Fulani have no ideological bonds, as do militant Islamists. Theirs is an economic bond, as cattle herders who look for grazing land and water for their herds. She says observers must step back and take a longer view of Nigeria, which has more than its share of armed gangs.
There's also a link that some people have made to say that some of them are actually Boko Haram people who escaped from the northeast when the military had the massive crackdown. At the moment, there is a real fear from all corners of the country and that this is a massive security issue that isn't being dealt with properly.
Nigeria has internal conflicts from border to border. In the northeast, government troops have joined armies from neighboring countries to suppress a 7-year Islamist insurgency by Boko Haram. In the south, new threats are emerging as the so-called Avengers increase attacks on oil pipelines. And there could be a new religion-based war between the army and the Shiite community of Zaria. Recent clashes there have caused the deaths of as many as 200 residents. Hoffman says Nigeria's once proud military force has been weakened by the strain of these conflicts.
There are small fires going off all across the country. There is a serious issue of security, the overstretch of security forces, under-resourced, under-trained, and overstretched in conflicts across the country. So that is definitely a challenge for the government. And I think President Buhari is in the position to move a lot of things forward with a lot of the goodwill he has domestically and as well internationally, and has done so with the Boko Haram situation. And I think a lot of Nigerians are expecting that kind of action with these Fulani herdsmen and farming community clashes.
Should Mr. Buhari take swift action against the Fulani or whoever is perpetrating the attacks on Nigerian farm communities, the security fix may only be temporary. The tensions between nomadic cattlemen and farmers is based on the need for access to land. And as climate change reshapes the environment of West Africa, the pressure on the Fulani to find grass and water will likely be magnified. This is David Arnold, VOA, Washington.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the opposition says it will go ahead with demonstrations tomorrow against President Joseph Kabila. The opposition accuses Mr. Kabila of trying to delay elections until he can change the constitution to run for a third term. William Klaus has more from Kinshasa.
The opposition in the DRC hopes to strike back against President Joseph Kabila after two major setbacks this month. Moise Katumbi, as yet the only opposition leader to declare his candidacy for president, was indicted, accused of recruiting American mercenaries, which he denies. And the Constitutional Court ruled that Kabila can stay in office if November elections are postponed, as many think they will be. Kabila's term officially ends December 19th. The opposition has reacted furiously, announcing nationwide marches against what one major coalition called the gravediggers of democracy. Opposition leader Martin Fayulu told VOA the Constitutional Court is a subservient court, a court that belongs to Mr. Kabila. He says we must show the court that we do not agree. The administrations in many Congolese towns have refused to allow Thursday's protests, but they may still go ahead since the opposition argue the Constitution requires them only to inform the authorities of their intention to demonstrate. In Kinshasa, however, the march can take place as planned, following a meeting between the governor, the police, the opposition, and the UN. But there is concern about potential violence. Congolese security forces are known for their heavy-handed response to protests, and in recent weeks, police have violently dispersed several pro-Katumbi meetings in his hometown of Lubumbashi. And there are also reports that the ruling party is planning its own activities Thursday, which may only heighten tensions in the street. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned for Sunnyside of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Xiaogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.